This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Marla Damati. Today on the show, do you sleep under a mosquito net? It turns out insecticide-treated ones being used in PNG might not be as effective as first thought, according to some new research that finds that faulty nets may be contributing to a spike in malaria cases.
The malaria situation in PNG has actually worsened since at least 2015-2016. We were obviously asking like what would cause this kind of increase in cases. We saw that bed nets weren't actually killing mosquitoes as we had expected.
You hear more on that coming up in around 10 minutes. And the 2020 Olympics should have been going on right now. But with COVID-19, the games were postponed to next year. It's given athletes one more year to train. But in Samoa, the government's proposal to sell off equipment from the Pacific Games has left one Olympic qualifier disappointed. Ironi Lelua is now campaigning for sailing boats that are up for auction to be donated to his Olympic training.
It's definitely taking up a lot more of my time than it should. I'm training my ass off over here at the moment. I'm trying to make sure that I'm putting my best foot forward, but you can only do that so far with having the equipment that I've got at the moment. And so for me to kind of progress, I need to make sure I've got the best equipment, and it's all in the hands of the government at the moment.
More on that story coming up. But next, PNG's cases are on the rise as experts warn of a much broader looming health crisis in the country.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
As the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in PNG grows, now at 72 in total, with three people in a critical condition, there are warnings that measures to counter coronavirus could have much broader health impacts. A recent study warned that deaths from diseases like malaria, HIV and TB could surge over the next 5 years in countries like PNG because their normal diagnosis and treatment measures are being interrupted by COVID measures. We'll have more on that in just a moment. But first, a look at the latest situation. Here is the COVID-19 controller, Commissioner David Manning.
Total number of confirmed cases to date is 72. The total number of active cases of COVID-19 are 54. We have in total three critical cases that are currently admitted into our intensive care unit, of which two remain critical and one is on ventilation. Our total number of deaths still remain at two. So new cases today, case numbers 67 to 72, are all based in NCD. And from the case studies or histories, what it tells us in the National Control Centre is that it is very much widespread in the city.
And Port Moresby residents are being urged to stay at home and only leave for essential reasons. The Prime Minister, James Morape, is urging people to do the right thing.
The challenge is here, let me assure everyone. Government will not go to sleep. Amidst many challenges we have, COVID is presently our number one challenge with the effect on the economy. And we are on standby to do our best endeavours to ensure our citizens are not really pushed to the corner, pushed to the limit, but are attended to at the very earliest.
As the Prime Minister said, the government's number one health priority right now is tackling COVID-19. But as we've heard, there are warnings that COVID measures could mean that other health problems are exacerbated in years to come in places like PNG. So the country's health department still has to make sure children are being vaccinated and manage the spread of tuberculosis and other contagious diseases. But as Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby, provincial health authorities say they're already stretched.
Papua New Guinea's health system was already struggling before the coronavirus pandemic, but now it's being stretched even further amid the recent surge in the number of COVID-19 cases. A health worker in Port Moresby's General Hospital, who wants to remain anonymous, says the facility doesn't have the rapid testing kits needed to clear patients seeking treatment for other conditions.
There is a concern right now. He has asked that even if a patients coming in with appendicitis or a snake bite, or even, you know, we can have gunshot wounds coming in, and they would need treatment then and there. So their life shouldn't be compromised. So there is no, like, like we don't have a rapid test that can say that they are negative COVID and they can pass through.
The strain on the health system is being felt in other major centres like Mount Hagen, the biggest town in the Highlands, as the focus is placed on containing coronavirus in Port Moresby. Mount Hagen has one of the highest numbers of people living with HIV in the country. David Vost is the head of the Western Highlands Provincial Health Authority.
We are hoping that we don't get any positive cases, but if we do, we believe we can isolate them from the rest of the hospital so that the rest of the hospital can continue as normal as can be expected in a pandemic.
He says the health system is already fragile without an outbreak of COVID-19 to contend with.
The Western Highlands Provincial Health Authority has had no funding for the month of July. It is almost impossible to run the hospital and the other facilities without funds. So the system is fragile not only in terms of funding, the system is fragile in terms of leadership at a central level, the system is fragile in terms of core resources, in other words, we don't have enough doctors.
A recent study by Lancet Global Health on the impact of COVID-19 on low-income and middle-income countries predicted the number of deaths due to HIV, tuberculosis and malaria could surge over the next 5 years due to the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Michaela Seymour is the founder of Bush Doctor, and she's worked in Western Province for 5 years. She says the people there face a particularly high risk because of its proximity to the Indonesian provinces of Papua.
Indonesia, unfortunately, has just hit over 100,000 confirmed cases of COVID, and certainly a lot of concern about what's happening there and what that means for people living in Western Province along that border with Papua and Indonesia.
She says rural workers will need help.
What's really important is that we're making sure that these healthcare workers get the equipment they need to protect themselves so they can keep delivering services to these communities, especially in rural areas where, child mortality rates are so high, immunisation rates are so low. If we start losing momentum now and these healthcare workers are unable to provide these essential interventions, then we're going to start seeing the flow-on effects of this for the next sort of 5 years or so.
Acting Health Secretary Dr. Paisin Dakolala admits dealing with the outbreak is going to be a challenge.
Yes, there have been health issues that have been affected, and we are working towards getting back to balance it out and ensure that there's a balance in how we deal with the health needs of our country. One of our biggest challenges, immunizing and protecting our children.
More help is on the way. A team of 8 medical workers will be coming to Port Moresby from Australia after the PNG government put out a call for assistance from international medical teams.
Bethany Harriman reporting from Port Moresby. And a reminder, if you are in PNG and you're experiencing flu-like illness, fever, cough, sore throat, body aches or difficulty breathing, you can call the toll-free hotline. The number is 1-800-200.
In times of health emergencies, it's important to have accurate information. Always check the source of information you read, and don't share information on social media or WhatsApp unless you are sure it's from a trusted source. To find accurate, up-to-date information about the coronavirus, search for ABC Radio Australia, the World Health Organization, or your country's government, online or on Facebook. Being well informed will help protect you and your community from the coronavirus.
If you're listening from Papua New Guinea or Solomon Islands, chances are you or someone you know probably slept under a mosquito net last night. Now, that's because bed nets are widely used in both those countries because of their perceived effectiveness in preventing the spread of malaria. But the latest research, which has just been published, may change the accepted view. Scientists have found that ineffective mosquito nets may actually have contributed to a surge in malaria area numbers across PNG, and as Evan Masuka reports, they're calling on the World Health Organization to take action.
Malaria has long been a major health problem for Papua New Guinea. In 2006, PNG introduced mosquito nets laced with long-lasting insecticide. The nets protected the people sleeping under them and kill any mosquitoes that land on them. Millions of nets were distributed and the prevalence rate of malaria dropped by almost 15%. But just a decade later, researchers have noticed a reverse in that trend.
The malaria situation in PNG has actually worsened since at least 2015, 2016. Malaria cases in PNG have gone up significantly. And as the WHO publishes a World Malaria Report every year, and in one of the last malaria reports, it said that there has been a ninefold increase in malaria over the last years in Papua New Guinea.
Dr. Stefan Karl is a senior scientific officer at the Australian Institute of Health and Tropical Medicine. He's also with the Institute of Medical Research in PNG and has spent the last 4 years studying the malaria problem.
We were obviously asking like what would cause this kind of increase in cases. But back then, we were more thinking along the lines of, you know, drug stockouts and things like this, or maybe changing mosquito behavior or something like this.
But even when supplies of anti-malaria drugs resumed, the number of infections remained high. Dr. Karl says researchers then zeroed in on the mosquito net with the brand name Permanet.
In 2018, 2019, and went out to, you know, different villages and collected, you know, bed nets, used bed nets from, you know, from people in the village. And then we started testing them. We saw that those bed nets weren't actually killing mosquitoes as we had expected. And so then that led us to also test completely new nets that were just arriving in PNG prior to the distribution. Yeah, and to our great surprise, we basically observed the same thing. These nets weren't actually killing, you know, the mosquitoes as they seemingly used to be a couple of years earlier.
Tim Freeman is the program manager for Rotarians Against Malaria and one of the research paper's co-authors. His organization distributes bed nets across PNG on behalf of the Department of Health.
In 2015, we thought we were getting very close to eliminating. And ever since 2015, malaria has been going up every year. So to put it mildly, I'm disappointed would be the word I could use at the mildest level.
Mr. Freeman says the mosquito nets still protect those sleeping inside, but they're not killing mosquitoes in the numbers they used to. And that, Dr. Karl says, affects community transmission.
So if they are out there and mosquitoes are bumping into these nets, you know, randomly throughout time, then they will reduce the overall number of mosquitoes in the community and thereby actually also protect people who are not sleeping under a mosquito net every night. And I think that's not happening to the same degree as it used to.
Dr. Karl says researchers haven't figured out what exactly is causing the problem, but they do know it's limited to mosquito nets made in the past 5 years.
To our surprise, the chemical tests actually show that the nets seem to have the correct amount of insecticide in them. So there must be something else, something more detailed or intricate that causes these nets to lose their efficacy. We are quite sure that, I mean, with research, it's always, you know, there's always a bit of a risk that, you know, this is some kind of, you know, artifact or something like that. But our results have actually been replicated by now in 4 different laboratories, you know, across the world, one in Vietnam, one in the UK, and an African one, and they all came back with, you know, relatively similar results to ours.
Mr. Freeman say they became suspicious about the mosquito nets in early 2019 and informed their donors. Now they're looking for alternative suppliers for PNG.
But the bottom line is the people who control this market would be the World Health Organization, because they're the ones who set the standards for what nets should be. So the first question is, have these nets... It may be that they would be the ones to say whether these nets are good or not.
So what does this all mean for the average Papua New Guinean? Well, Dr. Karl's advice is for everyone to continue using the same bed nets while new supplies are being sorted.
You know, the nets still provide protection against mosquito bites. You know, once you're underneath the net, it represents a barrier, you know, between you and the mosquito. So it will still protect you, you know, if you sleep under a mosquito net every night.
Dr. Stefan Karl from the Australian Institute of Tropical Health and Medicine.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, coming up soon, you're going to hear all the latest updates on that mysterious plane crash in PNG, where an Australian registered plane was found without its pilot. And there have been developments, and you'll hear about that coming up in News Wrap. But first, let's have a song. This is Ava Max with Kings and Queens.
If all of the kings had their queens on the throne, we would pop champagne and raise a toast to all of the queens who are fighting alone. Baby, you're not dancing on your own.
That was Ava Max with the Kings and Queens. It's time now for the latest weather update from across the region. And I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Marla.
Now, what is the weather looking like in the region at the moment?
We have pretty quiet conditions continuing across the southern part of the Pacific. There's really not much going on, and most of the major population centres stretching from Moresby in the west across to Papeete in the east should enjoy a pretty nice sunny day. There's trade winds right across the South Pacific at the moment, keeping things pretty settled, and weather is fairly mild, not too hot, not too cold, you know, in the Goldilocks region there, just right.
Now, Neville, we haven't spoken to you over the past few days because you've been stuck in Australia but have finally been able to fly home, and you were back in Fiji. How was that trip back for you?
It went surprisingly well, I have to say. I would say a big thank you to all of the people in the process. There's a lot of people managing the limited number of us that are moving about. In Australia, we were well handled by Border Control and our airline in New Zealand. No dramas there. Did lose a piece of luggage for a little while, but that sorted out. But then had an overnight in Auckland in transit. That went not too badly, although I have to say it would be great if the folks in Auckland Airport could open up a coffee shop. There was not much on offer for fare for breakfast when we were in transit, but certainly everybody there was equally as helpful. And then finally, arriving in Fiji, I wasn't really certain what to expect, but I have to say, again, very well handled by the Ministry of Health in Fiji, ably assisted by the Fiji military forces. We were processed very quickly, given absolutely clear information, taken directly to our hotels, and given all the things we needed to endure the 2 weeks of quarantine. So I'm tired. It was a long trip, but I'm happy to be here and very happy with the way it was managed from start to end.
Absolutely. Now, did you have to take the COVID test when you arrived?
No, we did not. We were collected into a secure area. Everybody was advised that they would be going straight to their hotel. We were then dispatched on buses. We were checked for any symptoms, although not tested. We were advised that if we developed any symptoms, who to contact, where to go, what to do, given a list of numbers. Nobody seemed to have any significant symptoms. There was a group of us, a large retinue of us on the same flights, and I have to say nobody seemed all that concerned. We were all masked up and using gloves, etc., on the journey, just to make sure that we stayed safe ourselves or we didn't pass anything on. So I'm pretty optimistic we'll come out of this at the end with a clean bill of health, and I can see that there is the possibility here for a process whereby some opening up of potentially of tourists coming back into the region in the future, if they can manage this as well as they have. Obviously, quarantine is going to limit the numbers.
Absolutely. And talking of quarantine, it's 2 weeks in the hotel. What are you going to do to fill your time?
First of all, I'm going to do a lot of sleeping. And then after that, I have some work to catch up on.
I can still work quite well here. We've been blessed by the fact that the hotel we're in provides us with free Wi-Fi. That helps me to do my work catch up on a few other issues. I've got a couple of reports I've got to write and that sort of thing. So this gives me some clear air to do some of the work that I've been putting off for a little while.
Well, I'm glad that you have the time to do the work and that you're back home in Fiji, close to your family, although you do have to do that two-week quarantine. But we'll be sure to keep chatting with you over those 2 weeks to give you a bit of normalcy, and hopefully we can see you back with your family soon. But thank you so much for joining us this morning and giving us that weather update.
No worries. Thanks, Marla.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather, giving us the latest weather updates. And for weather updates from across the region, you can head to Facebook and search Nandraki Weather. Now, I like to spell it out. It is Nadraki. It's time now to get some news from across the region and the world. And to do so with me this morning is Jordan Fennell. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Marla.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you.
It's
yes.
Fantastic. Now, we've been following this story across the week. It just keeps getting a little bit more mysterious and a little bit more clear at the same time. I'm talking about that mysterious plane in PNG. Now, the Australian registered plane crashed on Monday and the pilot was nowhere to be found. But now, in further developments, police in Papua New Guinea say a criminal syndicate was attempting to fly illegal drugs from PNG to Australia. Tell me more.
That's right. The Australian registered twin engine plane was found empty with its pilot on Monday, as you said, near what appeared to be a makeshift runway in Papalele, which is about 30 kilometres northwest of Port Moresby. The plane was not cleared to enter PNG, and flight tracking shows it set out from Mareeba in far north Queensland on Sunday morning. Local media is reporting that the Australian pilot handed himself into the Australian High Commission in Port Moresby on Wednesday and has since been charged with illegal entry. The Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has also said that it is providing consular assistance to a man detained in PNG but didn't comment any further.
Now, do we know if police or do police know what this Australian man was doing with this plane?
So the Australian Federal Police and the PNG Police are working together to investigate this. In a statement, PNG Police say it was alleged the pilot attempted to collect drugs between about 1 p.m. and 2:30 p.m. local time on July 26. The plane is believed to have crashed while attempting to take off. PNG Police Commissioner David Manning is urging those with information to come forward, saying that he believed PNG members of a criminal group assisted the pilot and retrieved the drugs from the plane.
We will definitely keep our eye on this investigation. And if you do want to read more about all the mysterious details surrounding the plane crash and the alleged drug run, you can find our article up on the ABC website. Now let's turn to another story. The Australian government is going to announce a pilot program that would allow 200 workers to travel from Vanuatu to harvest mangoes.
Yeah, this will be the first group of international workers allowed into Australia since borders shut because of coronavirus. It will be under the seasonal worker program, and the government will allow up to 200 workers from Vanuatu, like you said, to harvest mangoes in the Northern Territory. And so this is just announcing a pilot program. The government actually hopes to eventually bring in up to 1,000 people if all goes well.
Now, why will these workers from Vanuatu specifically be allowed to come over, especially considering we have closed our international borders because of coronavirus concerns?
Well, Vanuatu has recorded no cases of coronavirus. Plus, once the workers do come over, which could be as early as August 20th, they will have to quarantine for 2 weeks anyway. So they likely actually wouldn't begin working on the farms until September because of that quarantine period. Northern Territory Minister Paul Kirby, said that their state government had already tried to match local unemployed people to start working in the farming sector, but that there isn't enough available to actually meet the demand that they have there. And farmers have been saying that they need heaps of workers to get them through the spring and summer harvests.
Well, I know that farmers across the country have become concerned that their crops could be left to rot without access to foreign workers that typically work on Australian farms. So I am sure a welcome move for them. But we will no doubt want to find out how the seasonal workers in Vanuatu are feeling about this as well.
Exactly.
Now, turning to our final wonderful animal story, a giraffe at Australia Zoo has set the Guinness World Record as the tallest in the world.
That's right. Forrest the giraffe is 12 years old and stands tall at a crazy 5.7 metres. Most giraffes measure between 4 to 5 metres. And zookeepers at Australia Zoo say that he is still growing as well.
That's so 5.7 metres and he is still growing. I cannot imagine how much taller Mr. Forrest the giraffe is going to grow. But my question and my thinking is, how exactly do you measure a giraffe? Do you do it in a crane, in a plane? Do you kind of climb a couple ladders and, you know, hold out the tape measure?
Yeah, I was really interested to find out that they actually just ended up using a really tall ruler, just a huge ruler for Forrest the giraffe. And zookeepers said that it actually took months of work to get Forrest to stand next to the ruler because apparently giraffes are really nervous creatures and they don't like new and weird things. And they finally got him to do it, though, with the help of some food. He stood next to this really tall ruler, and then they used a bunch of cameras that circled him from every angle to get an accurate reading.
I feel like the ruler wouldn't be so scary as the drone kind of just floating around the giraffe trying to get the photos. But Jordan, when we were sitting earlier preparing for the show, you told me a really interesting tidbit of information about giraffe births. Can you please share? Because it is so amazing, and I think everyone needs to hear this.
It is fascinating. Yes, I read it as I was looking up this story about Forrest the giraffe. So giraffes are very tall and they don't like to sit down. Apparently they only like to remain standing even when they're sleeping because apparently they get nervous about how long it takes them to stand up because of their huge long necks. Because they're standing up all the time, they're standing up even when they give birth. And so a baby giraffe calf will just drop out of the mother down onto the ground, often several meters that they have to drop. But this is apparently actually needed because when the baby giraffe hits the ground, that hitting of the ground gets their heart started to pump the blood through their really long necks.
It's just amazing.
Nature is crazy.
Nature is crazy. I definitely wouldn't want to be dropped a couple meters when I was just born, but apparently baby giraffes need this. Jordan, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
No worries.
That was Jordan Fennell with the stories making news across the region and the world.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, coming up soon, you're going to hear from Matt Cannon, the CEO of Papua New Guinea's St. John Ambulance, about how they are on the look for new volunteers as the coronavirus cases continue to rise in the country. But first, let's get a little bit of music. This is a new one, and it's a new one from Daryl Braithwaite. This is Love Songs.
I've been writing love songs since we broke up. Guess that it took losing you to make me sure enough. And I know it's too soon to try again. We'll mess it up again. It's too soon to say goodbye. I've been writing love songs.
Daryl Braithwaite with Love Songs, and I was just told that song was potentially actually written for Pink, but it ended up in Daryl Braithwaite's hands, and I have to say it's a pretty good song.
Pacific Beat at 6am and 7am weekdays on Radio Australia.
Many Indigenous Pacific cultures have hierarchies. Your chief is the most senior and respected person in the village, for example. But when it comes to social media sites like Facebook and Instagram, who and what is the Indigenous authority?
Our engagement with social media, specifically Facebook and Instagram, but also Twitter, fragments what we understand to be traditional forms of communication and hierarchical authority. Because we are dealing with multiple contexts and multiple time zones, collapsed contexts online, it makes it really hard to kind of regulate how people communicate with each other and to build protocols around how people can do that safely and respectfully.
Pacific Beat, 6am and 7am weekdays on Radio Australia.
That's right, you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Marla Damati. Now, in case you missed it earlier, the total number of confirmed cases in PNG has risen to 72, with three people now in a critical condition. Authorities are ramping up testing in the capital, Port Moresby. The emergency controller, David Manning, announced testing clinics have been set up in different suburbs around the city, including drive-through tests.
We expect to mobilise up to 25 Papua New Guinea Defence Force staff to support swabbing at clinics. NCD surveillance team and drive-through clinics supported by St John's Ambulance will commence or has commenced in the city.
And with its new workload, St John Ambulance is on the lookout for new volunteers. Matt Cannon is the organisation's CEO, and he says they've been flooded with applications to volunteer. But he's worried about the ability for the health system to cope with the growing number of COVID-19 cases. I caught up with him a little earlier.
St John PNG supporting the national government's response to COVID-19. We have around 208 people at the moment working in various different roles, including public health activities, logistics, surveillance, but importantly, ambulance services. So at the moment, we've identified for additional help in warehousing of PPE for all the public health workers in Port Moresby, in the nation's capital, so that PPE kits can be made quickly available to the hospitals and the public health facilities, including the field hospitals that we've set up in Port Moresby. As well, we're seeing an increase in workload in the ambulance service. So every time that there is a COVID-19 patient, we're having to transport that patient from where they are to the isolation hospital so they can get treatment there. It takes about 3 hours for us to turn around each of these patients. So we're asking for volunteers to help us with the decontamination of ambulances. And of course, they'll be provided with proper training and proper personnel protective equipment.
And how has the uptake been so far in terms of applications to volunteer for St John's?
The uptake has been overwhelming. I think we're filtering through over 200 applications. We'd already started the process back in February, March, and we're continuing that. So over 200, and it's been an overwhelming support.
With volunteers, at the moment there is a lot of stigma with frontline health workers. Many nurses aren't able to go home to their families because their families are worried that they will bring the virus back home. Now, have you heard anything from the applicants in terms of being worried about the stigma or the impacts of potentially taking on this volunteering role?
Absolutely. There is stigma and there is concern all around the world. And I think that it is important that we engage with the volunteers and with our staff's families to help them understand what risks there are. But the reality is for us here, COVID-19 is spreading in the community. And it is just as possible that a staff member could get infected from their own family at the house. So that's why what we are doing is focusing our efforts on helping people protect the elders in the community, protect their family, and making sure that the focus is on good infection control measures being implemented, not just in the ambulance service, not just in the hospitals, but also in the communities.
So tell me, what is it like on the ground at the moment for St John and the ambulance organisation there? Because we know that there are a growing number of COVID-19 cases in Port Moresby, but also a new case popping up in Leh and, you know, other parts of the region. What is it like on the ground for you guys at the moment?
Look, I think I'd be lying if I said that that we were all confident. I think I'd be lying if I said that we didn't hold grave concerns. This virus doesn't discriminate. It affects nearly everyone, but unfortunately, it does seem to affect the elderly and those with, you know, heart conditions and diabetes much worse than other people, where the average healthy person might be able to fend off the virus themselves. Those with heart disease, those with diabetes, and those with other chronic medical conditions just can't do that. So there is a great sense of concern. I think that the health systems here are often working at 100%, and doctors and nurses are dedicated at the front line. And I think when you've got a system that operates at 100%, any extra workload is concerning. And what's in line for us over the next few months is really unclear at this stage. And modelling predicts that it won't be a good situation.
Now, PomGen is actually asking for supplies. They're asking for donations of PPE and even cars. Now, St John Ambulance, are you guys equipped to deal with what looks like it could be quite a widespread pandemic in Papua New Guinea?
Look, what I can say at this point in time is that there is a large stock of PPE. That stock will need to be refreshed soon. We will need to continue to order PPE for as long as this situation affects us all. Looking at the numbers and what we're doing, which is warehousing and helping to pack all this PPE into kits that makes it easier for the nurses and doctors to just simply open one bag and it's got their personal supply of PPE. At this present time, we have a large quantity of PPE, but that PPE will be depleted soon. And it is so important that we're continuing to receive the support and continue to order PPE so it stays in stock.
Before we mentioned as well, you have had an overwhelming response in terms of volunteers, which is fantastic and sounds like it is very much needed. But what protocols are being put in place by St John Ambulance to make sure that these volunteers are protected not only on the job itself, but also from the virus? And if they were to catch it, what support mechanisms are there for them?
Look, I'm really glad you asked that question. In terms of protocols for safety, we're a member of the Council of Ambulance Authorities, Australia and New Zealand, and we've worked with them to customise protocols that are relevant for us and achievable for us in Papua New Guinea. In terms of the protocols that we implement in any ambulance service, they should be identical to that implemented by any St John in Australia, St John in New Zealand, or any of the government ambulance services like Victoria Ambulance. Protecting the staff is first and foremost. So things like nutrition and rest breaks, we're working to make sure that those things are supported as well. And if staff become sick, there'll need to be support for them as well. And that's something that, you know, concerns us greatly, which is why we've been open and transparent with our team and made sure that the PPE and infection control training is first and foremost. I think it's going to be a testing time for us all in Papua New Guinea, and it will, we need more assistance and we need more help from within the region in our response to this virus here.
That was St John Ambulance CEO Matt Cannon speaking to me earlier. And another reminder, if you are in PNG and you're experiencing flu-like illness, fever, cough, sore throat, body aches or difficulty breathing, you can call the toll-free hotline, which is now working 24/7. The number is 1-800-200.
If you are working or shopping at a market, there are some important things you can do to slow the spread of coronavirus. Don't get too close with other shoppers and market workers. 1.5 meter distance should be maintained. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, or mouth. Don't touch stray animals at the market, such as cats, dogs, rodents, birds, and bats. Wash your hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds after touching animals and animal products and after returning home from the market. Equipment and services should be cleaned frequently with alcohol-based disinfectant if possible. If you are older or have a medical condition, avoid going to markets. Following these steps can help slow the spread of coronavirus.
Right now, the Tokyo 2020 Olympics were meant to be on. In fact, they'd be about halfway through. But of course, as we know, because of COVID-19, they've been postponed until next year. Athletes around the world are still doing what they can to train for the Games, including Aroni Leilua, who is Samoa's first ever sailor to qualify for an Olympic Games. But he's been distracted recently by reports that the Samoan government might sell valuable equipment that could be used for his training. The Samoan government has been auctioning off a range of items left over from when it hosted the Pacific Games last year, and Aroni is worried that a dozen laser sailing boats might be a part of the auctions, but he wants them to be instead donated to the national team to help his own Olympic training, but also nurture future Samoan sailors.
My name is Aroni Leilua. I was born in New Zealand and then raised in Samoa for my younger years up until I was about 12 or 13. While over there, I learned how to sail and then obviously continued sailing when we moved to New Zealand for schooling and was exposed to the sailing scene in New Zealand, which was quite a few levels higher than what it was in Samoa. I continued competing for Samoa at various events. And then, yeah, recently managed to qualify for the Games. So it's just been the main mission of mine at the moment is to train for that, despite being it postponed till next year, which has been a bit of a mental challenge. But, yeah, we've just got to keep training kind of thing and hope that it goes ahead next year. Once we qualified, it was kind of a quick replan of how we were going to prepare for this year's Games, thinking that it was going to go ahead this year. And then once we got the news that it was postponed, that kind of gave us an extra year to plan and prepare for what is now the 2020 Games in 2021. In Samoa, definitely, they rely heavily on events such as the Pacific Games to use the boats and equipment after the Games. So the boats and equipment they're using currently are from Games that we held there, I think it was about maybe or close to 10 years ago. Or even 12 years ago. So the boats are quite old and they're needing an update. And I think there was a lot of expectation for the boats that have been used from these last Games to be passed on and handed down to the club for the younger generation to learn and to progress and whatnot and aspire to attend, you know, future events representing Samoa. So it was pretty disappointing to see that wasn't the case. And understandably, well, from what I'm hearing, that the government obviously wanted to recoup some of the money they'd put into the Games and they've started selling off a whole lot of equipment, not just in sailing, but across the board to try and recoup some of those costs, I guess. But it's just come at the detriment of preventing or restricting progression in the Samoan sailing scene. It could have easily been the way of the government contributing to the sport of sailing in Samoa. I mean, the sport of sailing in Samoa in general at the moment doesn't get much funding from the government, if any. So it's all funded internally. And it would have been a good way to kind of contribute to that and to push the sport because it is a growing sport. I know it's a sport that's got a lot of potential. As we've seen in the last Games, we were quite successful with bringing home a few medals across the various classes and competitions, team events and individual events. So it's a sport that's shown it's got potential, but it just hasn't been given the love that it needs. It would have been definitely beneficial for not just the progression of sailing, but also for future events and the way that Samoa was represented on the world stage. I was also trying to get one of the boats across to me to help me with my preparations for the Games because the boats that they've got over there currently are the most up-to-date boats, quite similar to what we'd be using over in Tokyo. And so I had put a request in for some help in trying to get that boat across to me so I could better my chances in doing as best as I could at the Games. Because for me to go out and buy that boat over here, it would cost me upwards of $10,000 to $12,000. So for me to get one of those boats on board here, it would have helped. But now it's going to auction. It's going to probably come down to me having to buy these boats off the government to train for a competition which I'm going to represent Samoa, and it seems a little bit silly, but I guess that's just the nature of the beast. It's definitely taking up a lot more of my time than it should. I'm training myself over here at the moment. I'm trying to make sure that I'm putting my best foot forward, but you can only do that so far with having the equipment that I've got at the moment. And so for me to kind of progress, I need to make sure I've got the best equipment, and it's all in the hands of the government at the moment. Yeah, I guess it's frustrating for me. It just reduces the chance of others coming after me and pushing forward and aiming for the high prestigious events such as the Olympics or even just the Pacific Games. It ruins those chances from happening. And it's trying, yeah, because my goal is to try and pave the way for people to kind of aspire to do big things, and for them not to give the boat to the club is kind of just, yeah, it's completely pulled that to a halt. I know that the money side is big, but it's more than money when it comes to giving the boats to the club. It'll provide them with equipment and gear for the next, 10 to 12 years, as we've seen in the last lot of boats, and it'll potentially push us for more medals, both at Pacific Games and potentially one day at the Olympic Games. There's a lot of potential in sailing, and the main restriction at the moment in us progressing as a nation is the equipment and the boats. So if they, it'd be honest, I'd be very humbled and appreciative if they could relook at that, or even not sell all of the boats and sell half and then give the other half to the club, but at least give them something and a chance to progress.
Irone Leilua, Samoa's first ever sailor to qualify for an Olympic Games there. That story produced by Priyanka Srinivasan. And we asked the Samoan government if they did plan to sell the boats as a part of their Pacific Games auction. We are yet to hear back from them.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
I think we can squeeze in a little bit more music for your Friday morning. This is Nothing Else by Angus and Julia Stone.
You don't wanna be rich like everybody else does. You just wanna grow old, sit still while everybody else runs. In the meantime, tell me your star sign, I'll make something up about how you have to fall apart to really be someone. Nothing else to do here but kiss under the stars. I like you just the way you are. Nothing else to do here, just the way you are.
Some sultry tunes for your Friday morning. That was Nothing Else by Angus and Julia Stone.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +614 375 19 385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +614 375 19 385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
That's the program. Don't forget that Richard Hewitt will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. Keep listening to ABC Radio Australia across the day, and make sure you follow and like the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page as well. If you want to listen back to any of the stories today, like the story on the effectiveness of mosquito nets and the new research that suggests they might not be as effective as we first thought, head on over to our website. Just search ABC Pacific Beat into your preferred search engine. And a big thank you to the entire team here at Pacific Beat and the wonderful techs who helped put this show out. I'm Marla Damati. Thank you for your company this week. I hope you stay safe and well.